Last year, while traveling around the Netherlands and speaking with the farmers who are getting kicked off their land, we also wanted to answer a fundamental question about what was taking place. And the question was this: the Dutch farmers were getting kicked off their land because, at least ostensibly, the government wanted to reduce nitrogen emissions, with the thinking being, at least with the public thinking being, that if they did not reduce these emissions, then the natural environment will be ruined. However, is that really the case? Will the environment really be in danger if these nitrogen standards were not met? And also, what's the actual science behind these standards? I mean, the best weather models out there can only forecast about a week or two out, but these government nitrogen models, they were claiming to be able to foresee the future decades in advance. And so, in order to figure this out and to unpack the mystery, we went over to the home of Mr. Jaap Hannekamp. He is not only a scientist who studied the nitrogen issue for well over 8 years, and he was even commissioned by the Nitrogen Ministry to look into the matter, but also, aside from being an actual scientist, he's also a theologian, giving him a very unique perspective on the entire matter. And what he told us about these climate models, well, it was rather shocking to say the least. Take a listen.
Jaap, can you please introduce yourself and your qualifications in terms of the nitrogen debate?
My qualifications. I'm a chemist by trade. I did my PhD in 1982. I work in the field of risk assessment, risk management. I teach at universities both in the Netherlands and the US. About 8 years ago, I rolled into this debate basically on a whim, perhaps, but also out of interest because lots was going on. And 8 years on, I'm still working in this field, and I've published papers on the nitrogen case, but also was part of a ministerial committee which had to give advice to the cabinet of ministers in the parliament on the science of the nitrogen debate in the Netherlands. So yeah, rough and ready in that sense.
Wow. So you mentioned risk assessment. So I think a lot of people were wondering about that particular part of it, how you have politicians around the world right now talking about the risk of global food crisis, especially after what happened with Russia. And all of a sudden, well, seemingly all of a sudden, the Netherlands government, or the Dutch government, decides to essentially put 30 to 50% of farmers out of work, potentially at least.
Yeah.
What led to that? How did that happen?
Well, the nitrogen debate has been going on for the past 30 years, so it's didn't come out of the blue. It's sort of an ongoing debate, scientifically, politically, about how to deal with nitrogen's emissions and depositions on nature areas, from farms, but also from traffic, from industry, and basically every source which emits nitrogen has an effect on nature. And we're debating this for the past 30 years, how to deal with that. To what level do we find nitrogen deposition acceptable, and to what extent does nature is nature affected by nitrogen deposition? So that discussion is going on for decades. So it's not out of the blue.
Mm-hmm. So maybe for people who don't live in the Netherlands or don't quite understand, when you say nature area, can you sort of explain what you mean by that?
That's a bit of a problem because you know the saying, God created the world and the Dutch created the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. So that's the same for nature. We have changed the countryside for the past millennium. Nature is a result of what we do in the Netherlands. Now, that's all fine and well, but at least you can say we have certain types of nature in the Netherlands which are unique to the Netherlands, apart from the history of that nature. And it's also a densely populated area in the world. So we want to preserve the thing we still have, some forests, some heather, some little ponds, all sorts of habitats as they are known. Mm-hmm. And because it's so small, the Netherlands, we have very little area which we can call nature. There is a very strong drive to protect these areas from all sorts of influences. And the Dutch government has decided many years ago that nitrogen is the main issue, is the main influence on these areas. Mm-hmm. Whether or not that's true, that's, of course, part of the debate. And I think it's only a part of the issue of nature areas and the quality of nature areas. But nitrogen dominates. And I mean, by nitrogen, I mean, by the way, nitrogen compounds, not nitrogen, the gas in the atmosphere, because that's inert. Mm. We talk about ammonia, the NOx emissions from cars, from traffic, and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm. I imagine, I'm wondering about it, and I imagine a lot of people are wondering as well, is that, let's say when you start a garden, or you're gardening in your backyard, you typically use nitrogen to help plants
yes.
grow. So what is the danger of having too much nitrogen in nature areas? Won't plants just grow bigger and taller?
That's the issue. Nitrogen has a certain influence on certain plants and ecosystems. And the problem is regarded as too much of a good thing is not good for certain plants which do not want to use too much nitrogen. Mm-hmm. They're sort of the plants and ecosystems which actually thrive on less nitrogen than on more nitrogen. Mm-hmm. So it's about biodiversity, about changing ecosystem because of nitrogen deposition. So that's what we're talking about, basically.
Mm. Oh, so you're saying if you have too much nitrogen, certain types of plants will thrive while others won't thrive as much, right?
Yes, and the plants that won't thrive as much we have a focus on because, of course, they are more rare, mm-hmm. obviously, because, again, in the Netherlands is quite a densely populated area with loads of agriculture. So the more rare plants which do not want to have too much nitrogen, of course, remain rare. And they want to change that. They want to sort of have a go at those plants and ecosystems which do not want that much of a nitrogen we produce in the Netherlands. So that's a discussion.
What's the danger there if let's say, nitrogen critical loads continue to go up and those, let's say, rare plants don't thrive as much? What would happen to the ecosystem? Would it collapse?
No, I mean, collapsing ecosystems change continuously under all sorts of influences, climate, precipitation, temperature, you name it. And of course, in the Netherlands, because we're basically a delta area, groundwater levels are hugely important in the Netherlands. Mm-hmm. So ecosystems change, they don't collapse. I mean, that's sort of a apocalyptic terminology we don't need to use. Things change. Mm-hmm. And that change is regarded as a problem, basically. You can mention this as a problem, but of course the question is that an issue? Apart from the other fact is that you need to sort of invest to a certain level in these ecosystems. Mm-hmm. How much do you want to invest in these ecosystems in terms of money, in terms of removing the agricultural equation? How much do you want to invest in those ecosystems? And we haven't really discussed this at all in the Netherlands yet. Mm-hmm. So hopefully we will.
Is it just this wish to preserve these plants, or is there something more to it? Because I can imagine, you know, you mentioned risk-benefit analysis, right?
Yep.
The risk of losing 30 to 50% of your farmers versus the benefit of maintaining certain rare types of plants.
Yeah.
What's the like ratio there?
We don't know. Of course, there is a trade-off. I mean, if you remove, say, 30 to 50% of the agricultural force here in the Netherlands, you have a trade-off. Less food production, prices go up. There are all sorts of effects from that policy decision. But we don't know. We have no idea. Mm. What we do know is, of course, that loads of farmland will be changed over from one hand to another hand. Secondly, there is economic loss to be reckoned with. Thirdly, people get unemployed. And fourthly, our export mass will decrease, basically. Mm-hmm. But what is the return of investment from that? Well, we don't know. We have no idea what that will result in. Will result in better ecosystems, more diverse ecosystems. If you focus purely on nitrogen, the outcome will be yes. But of course, that's only theoretically, because there are many other impact factors which need to be accommodated in this whole equation. And if we don't do that, we don't know the results. So it's basically spending loads of money, getting people out of a job, changeover of land. For what exactly? We don't know. Mm-hmm. Because we haven't looked, we haven't analyzed, we haven't discussed this with nobody. So it's basically a decision of the government. That's it.
What are they basing their decision on? Do they have models in place?
Models, yes, models. the whole nature policy is based on two things. It's basically a deposition model, which is a computer model, mm-hmm. and the critical loads. The critical loads are basically derived from research where certain ecosystems are set to deteriorate above a certain level of deposition of nitrogen compounds. Now, the deposition model determines how much nitrogen comes from all sorts of sources, including the source you look at because of some change in agricultural size, more cows, more or less cows, and stuff like that. Now, the deposition model has been around for the past 30 years. And the committee I was part of sort of stated already that on the small scale, say a hectare scale, the model isn't that great. You can't really decide how much nitrogen deposition is actually results from all the activity we do. Mm-hmm. However, what we didn't get as a committee were the validation studies of the model, which are relatively old because the model is old, but we never got these validation studies. Mm-hmm. And validation studies are essential to determine whether or not a model is okay to work with. Has it any precision? Has it any skill? And skill is nothing other than can it predict certain values at a certain precision level compared to a simpler model? Mm-hmm. That's all. Weather models do this continuously. I mean, we have a rainy day today, and that was predicted yesterday that we have a rainy day today. So we know that meteorological models have skill. Mm-hmm. They predict within a certain number of hours with relative precision what's going to happen. The model, the RVM, the Environmental Health and Environment Institution in Bilthoven, has no skill whatsoever, we found. No one wanted to touch these validation studies that were out in the open because of a FOIA, Freedom of Information Act request. And my good friend Matt Briggs and I looked at the validation studies and showed that the model is actually crap. It doesn't work. In fact, the validation studies themselves say it performs poorly. Okay. The problem was we didn't get the data, the raw data, which underlie these validation studies. But the moment we published our first findings, we got the data within the hour. And now we're close to wrapping up the second part of our analysis, see how well the model does, in fact, do with the data we have. And the result is still no skill. It cannot predict with any kind of precision the deposition, which it says it will put out via this model, which is interesting, scientifically speaking, but also politically speaking, because the model can't do very much. It's not precise by any stretch of the imagination. Mm. So we don't really know what's happening with deposition from any kind of activity. And nevertheless, policy decides this is the amount of deposition we have seen, so this needs to happen, which is, in a sense, unsettling. I mean, really, can we do such a thing in terms of policy? Use a model which doesn't work for policy, which says, well, this is how much deposition we have calculated. For me, that's sort of a very strange situation to be in as a country. So that's the model side. Mm. And the model is sort of no. In fact, we state in the first publication, this model should never be used, should never have been used, and it should not be used now. It should be scrapped or improved or whatnot, but we cannot use it in policy. End of story. The critical loads are the other side of the equation, and critical loads are nothing other than so much nitrogen deposition per hectare per year. Otherwise, the ecosystem will deteriorate to some extent. Now, we have published this on a paper on this issue, on this topic, last February, and came to the conclusion that, again, critical loads are understandably from a political perspective, but not so much from a scientific perspective, because there are many questions to be asked. How precise are these critical loads? Because they are mentioned as precise numbers, so many kilograms per hectare per year, say 20 or 10. Mm-hmm. And that kind of precision is not part of the whole research on which these critical loads are based. Mm. There's much more uncertainty and much more questions on how much risk are we invoking if we exceed this critical load? Mm-hmm. We don't know. We have no idea. So the question is, are critical loads actually a workable approach to policies like this. Mm-hmm. And I'm not even discussing all the other parameters which we must include, like precipitation, climate, temperature, groundwater levels, and so on and so forth, because these also impact ecosystems. Mm-hmm. So we're a bit of a bind in the Netherlands. We've chosen a route which scientifically is, the model is invalidated by the validation studies themselves, and the critical loads are very questionable. So we're basically in a bind with respect to nitrogen policies.
Even when you said, in regards to the critical loads, when you hit a certain threshold, the environment begins to deteriorate. I guess that word deteriorate is a bit of a strange word to use if it just changes.
It changes. I mean, deteriorates, of course, the term itself presupposes a perspective on what kind of ecosystem I want, mm-hmm. and what kind of ecosystem I do not want, mm-hmm. or at least want to a lesser extent. So deteriorate is a moral evaluation of change, basically. Mm-hmm. And what we found in most critical load studies, change is studied. Now, change by itself doesn't mean very much. You want to know what kind of change actually is bad, is not acceptable, and stuff like that. And it proved to be hard to figure out from studies what the changeover is between change and deterioration. Mm-hmm. And many studies basically were only busy themselves with change. Mm-hmm. But change itself doesn't mean very much. Mm-hmm. Of course, ecosystems change if you add nitrogen. We know this. We've known this for millennia because that's what farmers do. Mm-hmm. So that's not unusual. But the question, of course, is what is unacceptable? Mm-hmm. And that question has not been properly answered within these critical loads arena, basically. Apart from the fact, and this is the third pillar I brought forward, standards by themselves don't mean very much. You have to figure out what the risk-benefit equation is. Mm-hmm. So in any field, I'm well-versed in the food safety arena, you evaluate the standards which you have devised from the lab, so to speak, and see whether or not they're applicable in real life. Mm-hmm. You have to think about that because any kind of implementation of a standard will cost you not just money, but also the way you produce stuff, the way you do things. So there are many things involved in implementing standards, mm-hmm. which is nothing out of the ordinary, by the way. Mm-hmm. In this particular case, it never happened. Scientists came up with these critical loads and basically said, we need these critical loads in policy, and beyond the critical loads, farms need to be closed, traffic needs to be diverted. So basically very, very deep change in society because of these critical loads. And that's a highly unusual way of working. Mm-hmm. This is not what we do with standards. Standards need to be evaluated. It needs to be evaluated across a whole range of risks and benefits. Mm-hmm. Never been done. And as an expert in that field, I find this utterly surprising and disconcerting very much.
So let me just get clarification on this. You were working for the government committee to study the nitrogen.
Yes.
You were given a model.
Yes.
However, when you went to actually look at the validation studies that created that model, you were denied those studies.
No, we didn't know these validation studies existed. Uh-huh. And we never asked for it. But of course, that's neither here nor there. I mean, in the scientific debate, you hand over the stuff you have. That's what you do in science. Mm-hmm. You're completely transparent on what you have been doing with the model or whatever. I mean, it's not criticizing using models per se. That's mm-hmm. not the issue. But the issue is how good is a model and how is the model validated? And the validation studies were simply not on the table. Mm-hmm. We didn't know they existed. And that was sort of a shock to me because this is not what we do in science. We show in transparent ways what we do. Mm-hmm. And again, the validation studies proved to be very quite clear on the fact that the model didn't work very well.
Mm. So you earlier compared the weather forecast, right? So instead, I think a lot of people imagine these models are like weather forecast, where you know, okay, you take out these farmers, you get this X product. You're saying they're more like maybe turtle shells, right? Like you kind of jingles together some turtle shells and you predict the weather. Is it more like that?
Weather models are continuously tested on skill, and skill is nothing other than you have a complicated weather model and you compare it to a more simple model. And if the simple model outcompetes the more complicated model, it is said that the complicated model does not have skill. And if it's vice versa, the more complicated model does its work well compared to the simple model, the complicated model, which we use every day on our phones, have skill. First, the model the RVM uses, the Arius OPS, is never tested on skill, which is very unusual. And secondly, once my friend Briggs did the skill test, it showed it didn't have any skill. Even the most simple, crude mean model, as they say, a mean model is nothing taking the average of concentrations, outperformed on almost every level the OPS model. Mm-hmm. And that's shocking, because even the most simplest of models could outcompete a very complicated model the RVM uses in policy.
And what did it show versus what the government's model predicted? What did your model show?
Well, our own model, which is just a mean model, which is you can hardly call it a model, actually showed that we were more precise in our predictions about certain deposition than the OPS model was. Mm-hmm. And that's shocking, because the OPS model shows very beautiful pictures of very precise numbers, how much deposition is calculated, and it's completely meaningless. There's nothing there. It's just an empty shell, basically. You just look at a screen with very nice pictures, very nice colors, and very nice numbers, but it's just a facade. There's nothing there. Mm-hmm. And that's shocking, because keep in mind, the model itself is ingrained in law, and they say if you do anything, that model must be used to show that it doesn't impact deposition on certain nature areas. So it's a serious model, so to speak, mm-hmm. with a no serious content.
And is that the model that's being used to determine what areas need to reduce nitrogen by how much?
That's the model. Yes, that's the model. We only have one model. That's it.
So this model is having real-world effects on a lot of real farmers.
Absolutely, has real-world effects. And I find this utterly surprising that this is acceptable. I mean, scientifically, the model is unacceptable. We use that term precisely. It's an unacceptable model, should be scrapped immediately, cannot be used by any stretch of the imagination. And doesn't matter, they still continue using it. Mm-hmm. And we have shown, as in proven, that the model is useless.
If let's say those farmers are forced to shut down, which they would be, if let's say even they are forced to give up 30% of their nitrogen emissions, a lot of them just wouldn't be able to absorb it.
Yeah.
Let's say that land is no longer used for farming. Would it automatically stop producing the nitrogen depositions that are above the threshold? Or let's say apartment buildings go up, would that?
No one knows. I mean, the idea is to reduce farming by 30, 40, 50%. Mm-hmm. What the consequences thereof are we don't know. Is this just going to be nature, or are we going to build houses, because we lack houses in the Netherlands, quite dramatically so? Mm. No one knows.
If they were going to use it for housing, what would that nitrogen profile look like?
Well, based on the model, I couldn't say, because it doesn't really produce any valuable numbers. But if I would just look at it through my eyelashes, so to speak, probably wouldn't change very much. Mm. It would remain the same, because there is traffic. There are cars now suddenly driving around, where formerly there were cows walking and grazing. Mm. So probably it wouldn't change very much. But even that question itself is problematical, because you would have the suggestion that you know, as in know, what's going to happen, and we don't, because we don't have any precision available to us. Other than emission tables, we have a car which emits on average X, we have a cow which emits on average Y, but these are averages, which are fine by itself, but the precision which is required, we cannot deliver, not by any stretch of the imagination, nothing. So that's a problem.
Well, because just having looked at that model, I thought, oh, of course that you have precision, because you know you know how much a cow emits, you know how much a car emits, and so if you replace X amount of cows with X amount of cars and people, like,
if you do it on average, it wouldn't change very much. But of course, the model itself suggests that it can deliver any kind of precision, so much kilograms or even grams or moles, the chemical term. That precision we don't have, so we're left with averages. But of course, policy requires precision, even precision to a very, very small number. We're talking about milligrams almost of nitrogen, which is completely irrelevant and trivial and nonsensical, but this is what we have done with all the legal battles we had the past 3, 4, 5 years. So that kind of precision is required, which cannot be delivered ever. So if we would average stuff, we would be fine, but we don't. So we're still left in the dark, basically.
Did something happen recently, and that's why the government seems to be accelerating their push? Was there something that happened maybe with these plans that they were trying to save? Or is this just a natural progression? We're sort of at the point where they're about to implement that.
No, we're about to implement the policy. Of course, there's a lot of pushback, including by me, on scientific grounds. And I'm aware of the fact that that model, Arias OPS, is in trouble. They know they're in trouble because we have shown, based on their own validation studies, that the model doesn't work. Not even close. So we're coming with a second round of analyses. So I think the acceleration is partly related to that they want to keep the model in the air as long as possible.
Oh, interesting.
But of course, that's a guess. I'm not sure. But I do know that the National Institute of Health and Environment did respond to our paper, the first paper. And they usually don't respond to anything, but in this case, they had to, I guess. I'm not sure.
How soon did they respond?
Within a couple of days. But the response was so laughable. I mean, it was absolutely hilarious. They didn't really understand what we were doing, that we had a sort of a great handle to respond ourselves using the data we now had, we didn't have before. So I think they are aware that they can't really keep up with us, basically. They are aware of that. Whether or not that's enough for the model to be scrapped, I don't know, because that's a political decision, nothing to do with science. Usually nothing to do with science every single time, so I'm not really that optimistic. But scientifically, and of course they state continuously that it's all science, the policy is science-based. They shouldn't have done that. They should have never said that, because I'm a scientist myself, so I know how that ball is played, basically. So I can play that game too, and we did, and we showed that, no, it's not up to par.
So after you showed it, are the other scientists who are studying this issue here in the country, are they beginning to shift their thinking about it?
No, it doesn't work that way. No.
How come?
No, it's too much ingrained in their system that we do the things we do the way we always did. So my criticism has always been the nitrogen discourse within the scientific field is no critical discourse at all. They continuously produce the same stuff over and over and over again, and there is no critical reflection or debate anywhere to be found. I'm used to the chemical discussions, in the chemistry fields I work in. There's continuously critical debate on almost anything you discuss, which is a normal process. In this discourse, nothing to be found. So the critique we have, let's put it this differently. The validation studies came out because of this FOIA, the Freedom of Information Act request. I would expect scientists who know what they're doing would actually look at these studies and say, hang on a minute, okay, this is interesting, let's have a look. No one touched these studies. They were like a hot potato. No one wanted to touch it. And of course, we jumped to the occasion immediately, okay, let's have a good look at this. But we were the only ones. No one even discussed these validation studies. Exactly my point. There's no critical debate in this field.
So I just want to understand, when you say validation studies, so these are studies where they take the model and they say, well, you know, according to the model, this input should have this output, and then they test it in the real world.
Yeah, it's just a test of the real world. You have a model, and a model should predict, well, a weather model predicts temperature within a certain range. And these models are pretty good. It was said yesterday that the temperature today in the Netherlands would be, in this area of the Netherlands, would be between 12 and 15 degrees Celsius. Checks out perfectly. What the OPS model was tested on is you emit a certain gas, you measure this gas in the field, certain distances, certain time, and then you let the model run to see if it could predict the same concentration found in the experiment. Mm-hmm. Couldn't do it.
Really?
Not even close. Nope. Nothing.
And, but these are still the models that the government is using.
Yes. So we were shocked, actually. Well, the lowest concentrations, they were close enough, but the higher concentrations, which are more important, they were way off. Mm-hmm. There's another thing. They test the model in the most easiest of ways. You have different parameters to test the model. You can do it very stringently or more lax or in a more lax way. They tested the model in the simplest, easiest way to let it pass. Mm-hmm. Of course, that's not how you test models. You test models stringently, as hard as you can, to see whether or not it can perform by any precision. And so it was tested on multiple levels. It did perform extremely poorly. Mm-hmm. So both in terms of prediction of measured concentrations of certain gases versus the way it was tested. It was tested in the easiest, simplest way possible.
You know, I've spoken to a number of farmers who told me that, well, because a lot of this ammonia problem with the cows comes from when the poop and the pee mix together, right?
Yeah.
So there's some technology that they had that they discussed installing on their farms that could actually separate those two compounds.
Yes.
What would that do to this nitrogen profile, do you know?
Well, it's not part of how we calculate the nitrogen emission. Mm-hmm. We simply say a cow emits, on average, say so much kilograms ammonia per year. And whether or not the farmer actually tweaks his way of rearing his animals is irrelevant. Mm-hmm. It's not part of the equation, so to speak. So it was never about the goal, but it's about the means by which the goals were projected to be had. So if farmers implement this system, the government wouldn't care because it's not part of their own program. Mm-hmm. They wouldn't really incorporate their results into their system because it's not part of their system. So it's irrelevant.
So you're saying if a farmer installs the system, he can go back to the government and say, hey, you know, my nitrogen emissions are actually a third of a typical farm because of this reason. The government will go, well, according to our model, that's not the case.
Exactly. Yeah. Roughly.
That's fascinating.
It is fascinating. Yeah. So it's never about innovation. It's always about getting rid of farmers based on the model and the critical loads. Mm. That's it.
Who decided and what exactly are these rare plans that should be,
Ecologists. Ecologists have a certain way of dealing with that, a certain way of viewing this. So they determine what is... what kind of ecosystem should be maintained or protected or whatnot. That's it.
You know, you said that there's a higher level risk-benefit analysis, and I can imagine that it's true. If we want to return to the Garden of Eden, then yeah, we should stop all human activity, and that'll be the best thing ever, right? But then there's a cost to that.
But that's not the biblical story. The biblical story is, in fact, I'm also a theologian, I'm sorry, is also, once the Garden of Eden was there, it was for the humans to be maintained and to be taken care of. So that's human influence, basically. Mm-hmm. And it's not about the status quo, it's about development, about change, about human beings' impact. And of course, it's well known that human beings can ruin the countryside or ruin stretches of land. That's not a discussion. Of course we can. And we did, and we still do. Mm-hmm. But this is much more a sort of an ecologist discussion. Mm-hmm. Which ecologists decide on what kind of habitats at what price? But the price is unknown. The price is only known in terms of if we want to maintain this, nitrogen deposition has to be decreased by such and such. That means these farms and this needs to be scrapped from the Dutch map, basically. So that's the whole process, basically. That's it.
Wow. If nothing changes, let's say it continues in this gridlock. You know, nothing really changes. Let's say 10, 15 years down the line, what would happen to the environment if we maintain the status quo?
Not much. I mean, we have what we have, and we do know that we had a bit of a drought this summer. Drought is a relative term, obviously, because we live in a delta and we live in a sea climate. So again, people moaned about lack of rain, and I always said, wait for it. It's going to be autumn and the rain is going to fall, and there you have it. Mm-hmm. And we're going to be drenched this week for quite a bit. And drought, of course, influences, impacts ecosystems in this area of the world quite dramatically so, because groundwater is massively important for this country. Mm-hmm. Usually we have so much of the stuff that we have pumps continuously working the water out of the country 24/7, 365. We have too much of the stuff. If there is a bit of a drought, groundwater levels drop, and then ecosystems actually suffer from that. That's well known, but that's a bit unusual. So probably that will impact ecosystems much more so than anything else, which makes perfect sense for this area of the world. But other than that, it won't change very much. We can, and keep in mind, ecosystems in the Netherlands are heavily maintained. They're engineered continuously. Mm. That has a certain impact on the quality of ecosystem. That's well known, but we usually look the other way. Mm-hmm. For instance, heather is an old school ecosystem which was derived from overgrazing. Too many sheep, too many cows. Reduced the nitrogen content of the soil, and heather was the result.
What is heather?
Heather.
Is heather like a plant? Or
it's a plant. It's an ecosystem where heather dominates. It's the moors. Mm. It's a bit of a shrub, this high, and it thrives on a lack of nitrogen. Mm-hmm. But these developed in the 16th century because of overgrazing. Mm-hmm. If we leave that ecosystem alone, forests will come back. Mm-hmm. So those areas need to be maintained quite heavily in order to keep them. Mm-hmm. And that's for almost all ecosystems. We maintain ecosystems. So that has a certain impact. So if we don't change anything in the Netherlands with farms or traffic, nothing really happens. There's no deterioration, there's no collapse, there's nothing out there. No.
Well, but that's not the messaging, at least.
Of course not. I mean, it's the typical utopian dialectic. If we don't do anything, things will go to shots. Things will disappear and we'll be worse off. And that's classical utopian dialectic. It's the dystopia of today and the utopia of tomorrow. Mm. That's part of European tradition since the 16th century, so nothing unusual there.
And actually, you mentioned the past European history. It also seems like a very kind of, it's just this kind of like cyclical pattern of the rural versus the city.
That's the classical one. We have been doing that since the dawn of European civilization. I mean, the farmers versus the city. Agriculture versus the city. The farmers had to listen to the nobility, and now the farmers have to listen to the governmental institutions. Nothing has changed in that sense. Yeah. So I think that's part of the equation as well. Absolutely, yeah.
It almost makes me feel a little heartened to know that this is just the same thing playing itself out again and again.
It's the same old, same old. Yeah. On the other hand, there is now a sort of a top-down quality to this policy, which is extremely dominant, is extremely forceful, and the forcefulness comes from scientism, which is the ideology that science can fathom the world to its utter depth, that we understand the world fully because of science. That's what my colleague scientists within this arena almost continuously say. We have to listen to the science in order to know what we need to do so that we have a better future for tomorrow, which is complete nonsense. It's just ideological BS. And it's also quite dangerous. It's a dangerous way of looking at the world, because then it means nothing matters apart from science. Culture doesn't matter, history doesn't matter, religion doesn't matter, social interaction doesn't matter. Nothing matters but science. That is a very totalitarian, dangerous idea, which some of my colleagues happily embrace, which I for the life of me cannot understand. You don't need to be a theologian or philosopher to understand that that's complete nonsense, but also dangerous nonsense. Mm. If nothing matters than just science, then what kind of a world do we actually live in? Mm-hmm. Apart from the fact, of course, that science changes. If you would really embrace science, you would embrace fluidity, change, mm-hmm. because that's what scientists do. They change ideas because we have new ideas about the world. We have new data about the world. We do new experiments. But it's the ultimate static idea. Scientism is not about fluidity. Scientism is about complete status quo. Mm. This is what we know. This is what we should do. And no one should be asking us anything about everything because we know everything.
Yeah.
Which is complete nonsense.
It seems like it almost doesn't matter what you put on the pedestal. If it's humans doing it, whether it's religion or science, like in theory, that it could be a good idea, I guess. But like you mentioned earlier, the models that they're using, you've proven aren't accurate. But it's still, it's trust the science.
If you would say trust the science, then you say, okay, the first thing we need to do is scrap the model because I trust the science, I trust the data, I trust what I've seen. Mm. So the model should be scrapped immediately. If you say that, if you really take that idea seriously, but then of course, one does not take their own ideas that seriously. They probably embrace the idea of power much more than the idea of science. Mm. And if you would embrace the idea of science, you know that you have a limited perspective on the world. You only have a few stamps in your stamp collection. That's it. Mm. No more. There's so much out there which needs to be discussed as well. Mm. For one, the whole risk-benefit question, which hasn't been addressed at all on any level. Mm. And that's also part of the scientific equation. Mm-hmm. And strangely enough, people are not discussing this, mm. which, of course, and then, of course, if we still maintain we should follow the science or we should listen to science, then, of course, there's nothing to do with science. It's just blunt, raw ideology, raw power. Mm-hmm. That's it.
I know after the US and Europe exported a lot of their manufacturing to China, basically, what wound up happening is that on paper, they had less emissions while China's emissions skyrocketed.
Sure.
When you look at it from a global level, if let's say consumption here in the Netherlands and worldwide for things like beef and dairy products don't go down, sure, you might lower your farming, but that farming is going to happen somewhere else.
It's a classical trade-off. If you don't do it here, you do it somewhere else. Mm-hmm. And that will, of course, have also... I mean, nitrogen emissions are part of the equation of agriculture. Mm-hmm. You can optimize it because no farmer wants to see the nitrogen being emitted to the atmosphere because that's loss. So you want to optimize that. Mm-hmm. And guess what? The Netherlands is pretty good at optimizing agriculture. We've done this for the past 1,000 years. We're really good at it. Mm-hmm. So if we would actually shift production to somewhere else, you are absolutely sure that emissions will increase. Hmm. Absolutely. You're absolutely sure of that because we're really good at agriculture. We do this for a living for the past 1,000 or so years. So we know what we're doing. So, we're quite precise at this.
So ironically, it's almost like if you globally want to reduce emissions, you should have more agriculture here in the Netherlands.
Absolutely. Yeah, because the way we do it and the production levels per hectare is incredible. And keep in mind, agricultural land is limited in the world and is decreasing because of all sorts of things happening. Mm. So it's the epitome of a dumb idea to scrap agriculture here because it has to be maintained somewhere else or increased somewhere else. But of course, the idea is we should eat less dairy products and meats for more plant materials. That's, of course, the idea behind it. But that's, of course, an idea which you imbue on the population. Say you should change your diet. Mm-hmm. But then we're in a totally different ballgame. That's a totally different discussion. Mm. Which is unrelated to agriculture itself. Mm. Because now agriculture is projected as bad for ecosystems, bad for habitats. But of course, behind that, you could think of ideas of we should change our diets. Mm-hmm. But of course, that's not how the world works. This is not how people are. So in the end, you will just shift your production somewhere else and increase nitrogen emissions happily. But that's nothing other than NIMBY, not in my backyard, basically. That's it.
Well, at the same time, they're pushing some of these like manufactured meat and bug factories at the same time. So I think they are actually moving, whoever they are, they're moving in that direction.
Could be. I don't know. I haven't really looked into that, but that could be well the case. Yeah, I don't know. Aries OPS is a model which tries to model emission transportation of certain chemicals through the atmosphere and the deposition, so of these chemicals to the soil, to the ground, basically. So it's going up, transport down. Mm-hmm. That's the model. And the model tries to predict with a certain emission, on certain emission levels, say a car emits so much grams of a certain gases, stationary, my car is running on the front side of the house, it would emit certain gases, and the model would predict the emission, the transportation, so how far these gases would travel in the atmosphere and where they would drop down on the ground. Mm-hmm. That's what the model does. It tries to predict all these different phases of the process, of the whole transportation logistics of these gases. That's what the model tries to do. Mm-hmm. And it's validated on experimental grounds. You let the model run with the experiment you've done. And ideally, of course, the experiment you do is not part of the development of the model. They're separate. Mm-hmm. So you've done making the model. Now you do a new experiment with new data and see whether or not the model can predict the whole process of emission, transportation, deposition. Mm-hmm. That's what the model does. And there are many models. This is only one model. There are many more models of that kind. But in the Netherlands, we only use Aries OPS.
What does Aries OPS stand for?
OPS, yeah, that's Aries is the name for the model. OPS is the mathematical engine of the model, so where the calculations happen. Aries is sort of the web-based shell where you can plug in numbers on the web and you can see what the results are. But the OPS is the mathematical model. It stands for something, but I forgot exactly what. it's an acronym. The model was developed at the beginning of the 1990s and has been developed continuously and tried to be improved continuously. So it's been around for close to 30 years or even more than 30 years. So it's been around for a long time. Mm. But now it's part of law. It's part of how you do your nitrogen policy. It's actually mentioned in the law that it must be used for any kind of development of housing or farmland or whatnot. So industry, anything that emits nitrogen or other gases, it's not just nitrogen, but there are multiple gases, and also fine particulate matter is also part of this model. This model must be used. Mm-hmm. But we only looked at, the whole model and the validation process and the skill of the model and the precision. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't good, as I told. Mm-hmm. Yeah. A couple of people at the National Institute of Health and Environment. So it was made in-house, mm-hmm, by mathematicians and physicists. So yeah, that's it.
And it was just like a curiosity, or they had like a problem they wanted to solve at that
time? No. It usually it's curiosity to see, can we build anything like that? Mm-hmm. And of course develops, and it's both. Keep in mind, the idea was, why can't we measure deposition of any kind of gas emitted? Well, you need hundreds of thousands of locations to measure, and of course that's not going to happen. Way too expensive, way too imprecise, and stuff like that. So a model, again, by itself is a great idea. But of course the model, like any model, needs to have any kind of skill, mm-hmm, predictive skill. Can it predict something new? Once you change anything in the setup of a farm or a car or whatever you focus your attention on. And that proved not to be assessed anyway and didn't prove to have any skill at all. So, yeah.
Thank you so much.